This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yahis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
Uganda's government is calling for international assistance as refugees continue to flood into the country from South Sudan.
That's VOA's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up.
The DRC Minister of Health has reported to the World Health Organization the outbreak of Ebola in the country's northern Baswell province. And Somalia's President Farmajo calls the signing in London of an aid agreement and security assistance a historic day for his country.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: an Ebola outbreak is reported in the DRC's northern Baswell province. There are 9 suspected cases and 3 deaths reported. One of the cases has been confirmed to be Ebola. DRC Minister of Public Health Dr. Oli Alanga Kalenga reported the outbreak to the World Health Organization. The WHO says the first teams of epidemiologists, biologists, as well as water hygiene and sanitation experts are expected to arrive in the area today or tomorrow. The epicenter of the Ebola outbreak is reported about 130 kilometers from Bouta, provincial capital of Baswell. It's located near the border with Central African Republic. The last time an Ebola outbreak was reported in the DRC was August of 2014.
Somalia and donor countries signed a new agreement yesterday at a one-day summit in London. It provides aid for drought relief as well as economic and security assistance. Somalia's President Farmajo called it a historic day for his country. The UN says $1.5 billion is needed for humanitarian support in Somalia this year, about $900 million more than forecast earlier in the year. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says with the 17-page security pact, all the conditions are now met for Somalia to be a success story. The pact calls for more international training of the Somali army to take on al-Shabaab militants. There are reports that the Somali president met yesterday with U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis.
Democratic U.S. Senator Chris Coons saw firsthand last month the devastation in South Sudan caused by the political and humanitarian crises in the country. Coons, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, says the United States is uniquely positioned to use its leverage on South Sudan's leaders, while at the same time create better ways to deliver aid. Ayan Bior has more.
Millions of South Sudanese civilians have left their homes in search of safety, while famine has been declared in 2 parts of the country, and aid agencies warn it could spread to other areas if immediate action is not taken. After visiting South Sudan's Unity State and Uganda's Bidibidi refugee camp with Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee in April, Senator Coons told an audience at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington yesterday that U.S. diplomats and lawmakers must come up with a comprehensive peace plan to urge South Sudan's leaders to end the conflict.
We have to find a way towards a meaningful peace process in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir can and should be a part of that process, but so far he has failed to show the leadership we would expect of a president. The United States, I believe, will step up and provide further pressure. Regional heads of state need to be engaged, the AU and the UN as well. If neither of these leaders are willing to take the leadership role that the people of South Sudan deserve, then we may need to find alternative paths to peace.
Coons is a co-sponsor of the Food for Peace Reform Act, a bill that, if passed into law, would eliminate regulations that require food aid to be grown in the United States, then shipped overseas to places like South Sudan. Coons says that process normally takes weeks, if not months. By adding reforms to the current Food for Peace program, Coons says the U.S. could save about $500 million a year and reach up to 8 million more people far more quickly than under the current regulations. Coons also wants the U.S. State Department to appoint a special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan, a position that has been vacant since January. Isaac Gung, who is the SPLM in opposition representative to the U.S., agrees a special envoy could help bring the warring parties to the table.
What we want to see now with the trip of Senator Coons and Corker is more administration involvement. Trump administration has been a bit a bit slow in moving forward with the selection of a new envoy and clearly engaging the political, the different parties to come to the table.
As the conflict has spread to previously peaceful regions in South Sudan, thousands of citizens continue to flee the country. South Sudanese citizen Char Paul, who now lives in the U.S. East Coast state of Virginia, has grown weary of failed international efforts to stop the fighting in her country.
I think the U.S., they do need to hold the leader of South Sudan accountable for what is going on. It is nice that they're helping out financially, giving aid, but just giving money, taxpayer money, it's not good enough.
Brian Adeba, a South Sudan analyst with the Enough Project based in Washington, says groups like the African Union and the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, which is responsible for overseeing the peace agreement, needs to step up.
When you look at the regional organizations that are involved in this peace agreement and its collapse, they're missing in action. They're also bedeviled with fractions among themselves, and so U.S. leadership is essential. The U.S. has a lot of tools and leverage that it can utilize to bring the parties in the conflict to the negotiating table, and I think it's about time that that is used.
The Enough Project has urged the U.S. government to utilize anti-money laundering laws through the Justice Department against corrupt South Sudanese officials and military leaders. Over 3.5 million South Sudanese have been forced to flee their homes, including more than 2 million people who are internally displaced. The UN Refugee Agency has asked for $781 million to meet the growing needs of displaced populations in the region. Of that, only 11% has been funded so far. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Uganda's government is calling for international assistance as refugees continue to flood into the country from South Sudan, straining already impoverished communities. Aid agencies are struggling to keep up with the health needs of the refugees, with malaria being the top concern. From Nairobi, Jill Craig has more, with additional reporting from Halima Atumani in Kampala.
Uganda, a country known for its progressive refugee policy, is hosting more than 1.2 million refugees and asylum seekers, with about 920,000 of them from South Sudan. Uganda's Prime Minister, Ruhukana Rugunda, says his country has been receiving an average of about 2,000 refugees per day for the last 6 months.
The above numbers are placing a huge strain on our already stressed ability to cater for the food, water, sanitation, health, and educational needs of the refugees and their host communities.
So next month, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, and the UN's Refugee Agency are hosting the Solidarity Summit on Refugees, with the aim of securing $2 billion per year for the next 4 years to help meet the funding gap. And as the refugees pour into Uganda, they bring a host of medical needs, further highlighting the need for additional resources. Dr. Martina Fuchs is the CEO and founder of Real Medicine Foundation, the humanitarian aid and development organization tasked with providing much of the health care in Uganda's Bidibidi, now the largest refugee settlement in Africa. The settlement hosts more than 272,000 South Sudanese refugees.
The largest disease burden is malaria, a very large percentage, especially in children, and then also pregnant women with malaria. So malaria is the highest. And then gastrointestinal tract infections, diarrhea, watery diarrhea, then respiratory tract infections, pneumonia, and then in smaller amounts, HIV/AIDS.
According to RMF, malaria rates in children and adults arriving at medical facilities range from 65% to 80%, fluctuating upon whether it is the dry or rainy season. Fuchs says that severe and moderate acute malnutrition is another problem, adding that refugees are also dealing with mental health issues as a result of the trauma they have experienced.
There is research that trauma actually lowers your defense, your immune system. So any kind of emotional, psychological trauma will interfere with your immune system. So you are more vulnerable when you are traumatized than if you're not.
Rosa Malongo, UN Resident Coordinator and the UN Development Program's Resident Representative for Uganda, says that in addition to catering to the refugee population, Uganda's host communities must not be overlooked either.
It is imperative to note that these 12 districts have some of the country's highest levels of poverty and the lowest levels of human development indicators. If we want to help ensure and maintain the asylum space in Uganda, the voices and contributions of these communities must be supported.
By the end of 2017, authorities estimate that an additional 400,000 refugees and asylum seekers will have arrived in Uganda. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. China's vice president has ended a two-day visit to Burundi. The visit came as the country faces an economic slowdown. Political turmoil and economic problems began for Burundi in April 2015 after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office, something critics called unconstitutional. Moses Habayarimana reports from Bujumbura.
The Chinese vice president, Li Yuanqiao, met for the first time with President Pierre Nkurunziza's efforts to strengthen relations between the two countries. President Pierre Nkurunziza held China's support during the political crisis. He says that they have brought a message from the president of China and that China will continue to support Burundi in development activities and also support them in their international interests. The two countries signed several agreements with China, set to support Burundi in agriculture and livestock, infrastructure, energy, health and education. President Nkurunziza said that it is a win-win situation for both countries. He says that he can say that Burundi is the only country that have problems and that there are a lot of African countries with problems. Even some African countries have failed to pay salaries for their employees, but Burundi is not facing that problem, that every beginning has an end. The visit by the Chinese vice president comes as Burundi's economic crisis that began in 2015 continues. The European Union and mainly Belgium have suspended aid to Burundi government. The aid contributed almost a half of the country's annual budget. China's government has expressed support to Burundi's government, especially for the community development activities. The Chinese vice president says his government has agreed to increase support to Burundi, including interest-free loans. He says that China continued to support many African countries on development projects, particularly Burundi, and also in the international community, in fight against foreign influence in the country's crisis, and Burundians should decide for their country. More than 55% of the new state house is financed by China. Also, China played a key role in vetoing resolutions in the United Nations that Burundi government opposed. These included deployment of the UN peacekeeping missions in the country. Last year, China donated $200,000 to support the inter-Burundi dialogue being mediated by former Tanzanian President Benjamin Mkapa. At least 500 people have been killed in political violence since April 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Burundians have fled to neighboring countries. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Nearly 53,400 migrants have crossed the Mediterranean to Europe so far this year, with the vast majority reaching Italy. More than 1,300 deaths have been reported. Greece, Spain, and Cyprus have also taken migrants and refugees. Meanwhile, Italy is preparing to build 11 more repatriation centers. The country is currently hosting 176,000 asylum seekers. Many more are expected during the summer months when the weather is favorable to crossing the Mediterranean.
Agriculture and climate change experts are meeting at the UN's annual climate change conference in Bonn, Germany. They hope to find lasting solutions to food insecurity, including the hunger crisis and drought gripping parts of Africa. An upcoming meeting this weekend will focus on ways of scaling up policies that will protect against the loss of harvest and livelihoods due to climate change. One important area under consideration is the use of drones and satellite imagery. They make it possible to develop weather-related indexes that automatically pay farmers when climate conditions damage crops or threaten food supplies. Bruce Campbell is director of CGIAR's Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security Research Program. He spoke with me about the importance of using drones and satellites to mitigate the loss of livelihoods to poor farmers.
The drones and satellites are able to view crops from the top and can do many fields at a time and frequently in the crop season. So you can get very quick assessments of what's happening in fields. They do very different jobs. Satellites cover large areas and the costs are much cheaper than drones. Drones are useful for relatively small areas for quick and detailed assessments of crop conditions and yield losses because of climate risks such as hurricanes, hailstorms, floods, etc. Satellites do these large areas cheaply. Drones are much more expensive, have to do smaller areas.
Would farmers have to invest in this technology?
At the current stage, you really need a service provider that is in between what the drones do and the farmer. So at the moment, we don't actually see farmers using them themselves. We see a service provider providing information from drones and satellite image for farmers. Things like monitoring food security, so this would be for at a national level, so that's not really an individual farmer. But perhaps really important would be crop insurance. So there's some really neat new crop insurance products, and they need assessments of what's happening with the crop, and this is where satellites and drones can help farmers. But there would be a service provider doing those services.
Many parts of Africa are experiencing a drought right now, so how could satellite imagery benefit farmers before a drought occurs, for example, and also during a drought?
You know, droughts don't occur instantaneously. They occur over a time period. What satellites could do, for example, is monitor what's happening and start sending out the warnings as soon as there's a deficit in rainfall. Going back to crop insurance, these products that I've talked about are called index-based crop insurance, where the insurance agent doesn't go out to every farmer's field and check what's happening. It's all done remotely. And so, for example, you use the satellites or the drones to check exactly what happened on the farm. You can do it instantaneously, and you can instantaneously make a payment out to the farmer. So the crop insurance payments happen very fast. This is already happening in Africa, in very remote locations like Kenya.
And also that really leads me to my next question, which was going to be, can it be said that this technology is the future of farming? And you just mentioned that in parts of Africa, it's already in use.
Yes. To go back to the crop insurance example, farmers are going to a remote rural store, buying seed, taking a picture with their cell phone of the barcode. They get a question on their cell phone, do you want crop insurance? You say yes, and you get it instantaneously through your mobile phone and payment happening from your mobile phone account. Then they go and plant the seed. If the crop fails, there's a measurement of the rainfall amount, and if the rainfall goes below a certain amount, the insurance company makes the payout. This is already happening in India, for example. It's already in the millions of farmers. In Africa, it's still somewhat experimental, but it's up into the hundreds of thousands of farmers are now using these kinds of things in different parts of Africa.
Bruce Campbell is director of CGIAR's Climate Change, Agriculture, and Food Security Research Program. He spoke with me from Bonn, Germany.
As developed countries place greater restrictions on tobacco use, developing nations face major industry campaign promoting smoking. One method being used to reduce smoking is a tobacco tax on consumers. VOA's Adam Phillips discusses the issue with a leading economic expert on tobacco taxation.
Economist and research professor Frank Chalupka has spent over 30 years studying how economic incentives can influence people's health-related behaviors, particularly tobacco use. Chalupka is director of the Health Policy Center at the University of Illinois in Chicago.
Tobacco use is the leading preventable cause of death in the world. So if we're looking at the numbers currently, about 6 million people die every year from diseases that are caused by tobacco. So it's, you know, a huge public health problem.
In addition to the immense physical suffering and death smoking-related diseases cause, tobacco use also exacts a crushing economic cost on society.
And we estimate that the economic costs are around $1.4 trillion in terms of spending on healthcare to treat the diseases caused by tobacco, but also the lost economic activity that comes from premature death caused by tobacco.
Low- and middle-income countries can employ several strategies to prevent people from smoking or to get them to limit or quit the habit. One is health education in schools, so young people are made aware of the dangers. Another is to require cigarette manufacturers to reveal the possible stark or deforming effects of tobacco use. In 2009, Mauritius became the first nation in the World Health Organization's Africa region to require cigarette packets to bear graphic images of the effects of smoking. These include photos of mouth cancer, lung disease, and open heart surgery. There are also cartoonish depictions of limp cigarettes that link smoking with sexual impotence. But Chalupka says that slapping a hefty tax on cigarettes is one of the best ways to discourage people from buying cigarettes in the first place.
Exactly. It's, you know, just like any other commodity, the more it costs, the less people consume, and the less it costs, the more people consume. And we've had hundreds of studies now from around the world that show over and over again that when prices go up, when taxes go up, that you see reductions in the number of people who smoke, reductions in how many cigarettes people consume, but also really effective in keeping young people from taking up tobacco use.
Critics of such taxes, most notably the tobacco industry, say tax surcharges unfairly target the poor. They say the tax would make it harder for them to buy cigarettes while not really affecting wealthier people. Tax advocates counter that even if that is true, the poor would still benefit from using less tobacco or quitting. In addition, when governments use tobacco tax revenues to fund public health programs, the poor benefit. Frank Chalupka and the University of Illinois Health Policy Center have received an $8 million grant from the Bloomberg Initiative to reduce tobacco use. They'll use it to help low- and middle-income countries accelerate the development of tobacco tax systems. Chalupka says the first priority will be to network with grassroots advocates who will work with governments to create tax programs appropriate to their own national cultures and economies.
So what we're trying to do is to find new partners in country that can help develop the local evidence and that have the ability to communicate effectively, work with governments, particularly ministries of finance, with a particular emphasis on the role of tobacco taxes in affecting tobacco use.
As tobacco production has decreased in the West, farmers in several African countries, such as Malawi, Zimbabwe, and Zambia, are picking up the slack. The World Lung Foundation says alternative and equally lucrative substitute crops must be found for those farmers. Otherwise, it says, a black market for tobacco will arise that will not contribute any tax revenue, but will contribute to poor health. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.